through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, we normally do this after every Seahawks game. Seahawks obviously out of it, but that doesn't mean there isn't still plenty that Seahawks fans can watch for and learn from these games that are happening. Now, we did this over the divisional round. We're going to do it again for the NFC title and AFC title game, and that is what caught our eye. All right, Jake, take it away.
First thing that caught my eye, Stacy, is that at some point you were just wondering if Josh Allen's youth was going to catch up to him. You go from this amazing transformation for 2 years in the league. You've shown that you're an inaccurate quarterback. You've shown that you are a risky, high-risk decision maker, okay, with a capital, all caps, high risk. And this year has been such a remarkable turnaround for him, partly because he has fixed literally everything. 69% completion percentage, not making risky decisions, putting the ball in harm's way often, and really becoming an all-around complete quarterback. In this game against the Kansas City Chiefs, I believe those old things, those old habits popped up for him. And you can see that he's extremely talented. You can see why the Buffalo Bills and Bills Mafia are so excited about Josh Allen and his future and the fact that they're going to be in the hunt for years to come. But this is also another learning lesson for him on one of the biggest stages. And a reason why they weren't able to get to the Super Bowl was Josh Allen making risky decisions. And it was an absolute killer in the third quarter. At the end of the third quarter, they're driving down, they're in the red zone, and Josh Allen, it's an RPO. He pulls the ball, he's going to pass it, and he goes to option number two, and it's not there. And instead of living for the next play, tries to force it. It's a huge interception that really seals the game at that point in time. So I think Josh Allen has had an incredible year. There's a lot to be excited about if you're a Bills fan and a fan of Josh Allen. But his youth did catch up with him. His prior past caught up with him on the biggest stage.
I think I don't want to take away from the very genuine and legitimate improvement I thought that Josh Allen made this year. He also had Stephon Diggs, and that made all the difference in the world. Guess in 2018, you guys are not going to guess this. Guess Buffalo's top receiving target.
John Brown?
No.
Ooh,
man.
Cole Beasley?
Nope.
Really?
2018. Dawson Knox?
No, LeSean McCoy is number three. Calvin Benjamin, number two. Their number one receiver in terms of targets, 102 targets, 652 yards, wide receiver Zay Jones.
Wow. Of course.
Yeah,
of course. Who
I knew that. It was on the tip of my tongue.
John Brown and Cole Beasley leading the pack in 2019. Getting Diggs made all the difference in the world. And you know what? Beasley actually had one more target last year. Getting Diggs helped Beasley too. It's just getting Josh Allen those weapons, that big number one receiver weapon, really, really did help. And so when you have a weapon like that, it does still manage to mask some of the mistakes that you're going to make. And so I think that a few of those did pop back up in this game. Those are things that feel fixable.
Mm-hmm.
But it is hard not to also say Diggs was a big part of his turnaround too.
Well, he was a big part of his turnaround. And also shout out to Brian Daboll for coming up with a variety of different ways to get Stephon Diggs the ball, right? And make him as big of a factor as he was for Josh Allen in year one. And I agree with you that the weaponry that Josh Allen had probably made a huge, huge difference for him. And we'll see if he's able to continue to keep growing with this group. But I also think that as you look at the game, the Kansas City Chiefs did a great job of game planning against the Bills and their concepts, and they really frustrated the Bills. They did not have a bunch of wide open guys. They forced the Bills to really earn it every single drive, and eventually it backfired on them. Josh Allen did make mistakes, and you saw at the end of the game he was so frustrated that when he got sacked, he threw the ball in somebody's face. I mean, unprovoked. The guy wasn't being dirty. Josh Allen was just extremely frustrated, and it caused this huge fight to break out. And guess what? My former teammate, John Feliciano, was the guy that came in and decked Okafor. But that's also, I love that in terms of a lineman. That whole thing was Josh Allen's doing. He started all that.
Yeah.
For an offensive lineman, you didn't see what happened. You just turn around and see that, you know, a defensive
is going at your quarterback.
Is going at your quarterback to stand over him. And so that's an offensive lineman's code. You go and go to bat for your quarterback. I love seeing that. And Mongo is his nickname, Feliciano's nickname. He did that many, many times. Witnessed that many times when I was at Miami.
Speaking of Kansas City's game planning, I think that the Chiefs have an unparalleled ability to get their best players open in space. That is what caught my eye more than almost anything else this weekend. I used Travis Kelce as an example of that being especially true. My favorite play of the game, this right here, cut number 11, the second touchdown pass to Travis Kelce.
Mahomes, Hardman, making the ghost action. They're going to run a float pass. Nissan, touchdown! Kansas City, Patrick Mahomes, a 17th career postseason touchdown pass, the most in NFL history in a player's first four seasons, finding Kelce wide open, and it's human pyrotechnics dressed in red, white, and gold.
Kelce could awesome. Have stopped, dropped, and rolled into that end zone. He had so much stinking space. You're in a third and goal situation. One of their top receivers, Kansas City's top receivers, is wide open, walks right in. Now, this isn't supposed to happen, obviously. Even if he's initially looking like he's going to block, which he is, you cannot let your eyes come off of him. So he runs behind the line to the left side. He's staring at Mahomes the entire time, but the Bills have blitzed at this point. They've sent six or seven, I forget which, and they've sent 17 streaking right. And so Bills defenders, I think it's led by Micah Hyde, call that out. So they start also
right.
following him to the right side of the field, and meanwhile, Kelce manages to just waltz on into the end zone after he's running to the left side. It seems like such a simple thing, right? Like you would just be like, oh, what a weird, uncharacteristic mistake by the Bills defense here. Normally you would know to watch this guy, but it's also great play calling and great execution. That's by the players, but that's by Andy Reid. It's by Eric Bieniemy. They just find ways to do it. You know that Hill is going to get the ball. You know that Kelce is going to get the ball, and yet they still manage to do it.
Well, you're able to drop a lot of window dressing. You're able to, in that moment, as you're talking about Mecole Hardman, you're able to get all eyes and focus and attention on him in that fly sweep and get everybody to believe that the play is going to go to the right. You slip Travis Kelce out the back door to the left, and he's wide open, and they take advantage of a bad play call by the Bills and Leslie Frazier. They try to bring pressure, and they're not able to pick it up.
Yep.
So I think that when you look at what the Kansas City Chiefs do, they are always one step ahead. And it's not just from a schematic standpoint. It's how they set up plays. It's how they self-scout and look at things that they've done previously. And how can they combat that? How can they look at what they've done and say, okay, if we do the same motion and give the same illusion of a play we've run earlier, how can we run away from that or call a play away from that that can cause confusion? And I think that that's one thing that I love about the Kansas City Chiefs that they constantly do and are able to get Travis Kelce, Tyreek Hill the ball every game. It's amazing how things happen when you fully trust and empower your quarterback. Bruce Arians with Tom Brady, letting him coach, letting him kind of take over the leadership of the offense, really in the second half of the season, as it was talked about on the broadcast, during the game, and then also trusting him to go for it on fourth down at the end of the first half. I mean, good things happen when you trust your quarterback in those moments. Now, that trust is earned, obviously, over the year, but that moment doesn't come if Bruce Arians isn't willing to look at his quarterback and say, I trust you. I know you're going to make the right decision. We're going to go for it. And then you look at over on the flip side, Andy Reid with Mahomes, he gives him so many stinking options. It's not, okay, we're going to call a pass play and we're going to give you five receivers to throw to. That's what every single offense does. But it's on every single play, whether it's choice routes, whether it's the ability to, on run plays, pass the ball as well and be able to get your guys in space like Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce. A lot of their big explosive plays, Stacey, happen on RPOs, run-pass options. And they did an excellent job at that throughout the entire game, and that is putting a lot of trust on your quarterback to make the right decisions in split-second moments, and it really paid off for both the Buccaneers and the Chiefs. They were aggressive. They went for the moment, and it paid off.
Well, and like you said, going with your strength even after you make mistakes. And you can look at that in both games in different ways. Brady, like you said, make a lot of those picks. Still going with Brady and your offense to try to make it pay off. Meanwhile, with the Chiefs, you made a huge mistake early. This was on special teams, not offense. But you didn't let it shake you. You didn't play conservatively because of that, even though your offense was hitting the field for the first time down 10. You still leaned into your strength, and you were still aggressive. I thought it was the right move to make. Why aren't we talking about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers as an underdog? They do not feel like one. But if you guys were to tell me, say it's 2010.
1,000%
Say it's 2013, okay? And you're like, hey, I'm not going to tell you who's quarterback for either team, and I'm not going to tell you who won the Super Bowl the year before, but the 2021 Super Bowl will feature the Kansas City Chiefs and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I would be like, good for them. Fantastic. Chiefs haven't made a Super Bowl in 50 years. You've got Andy Reid as the coach there. Oh, that's awesome. Get a second chance at redemption. Oh, and you've got the Bucs going in there after not making it to a Super Bowl since 2002, not making the playoffs since 2007. That's amazing. And yet, when the Bucs won, you guys know, because you're on this group thread, I texted our work group thread in all caps and said, "Rich, get richer," which makes no sense, but I can't help but feel that way. It's because of Tom Brady, but listen to me. Out of context, if you are someone that goes for the underdog, you can make a pretty good case for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Like I said, haven't won
they
a Super Bowl.
They are the
since,
underdog.
Listen, Jake, haven't won a Super Bowl since 2002. Stop trying to convince me. Haven't been to the playoffs since 2007. You've got a 43-year-old quarterback that you brought in when his team, you could make a case for, kind of were parted ways, gave up, figured that he was at the end of his run or didn't want to spend money to afford him. You have a tight end that came out of retirement to join your team. You've got a defensive line with all these likable coaches coaching it too. I mean, you can make the case that this is a team that is very much an underdog, and yet it doesn't feel that way because you've got Tom Brady with his 10th Super Bowl. Rich, get richer, Jake.
10th Super Bowl. But to me, as you look at the Buccaneers, they 100% are the underdog in the situation. They should not have been here. They got in wild card, won three games.
To say, number five seed that had to win five games on the road. You're right.
They had to win a significant amount of games on the road the entire way. They have been the underdog the entire way. Yet you have a quarterback who has been there, done that, has all the experience, and is clutch. And to your point, that's why they don't feel like underdogs. And that is an amazing accomplishment. Yeah. That's an amazing feat for this organization, for the Bucs. I don't care what talent they've had. They have not been this successful before Tom Brady was there in 1 year, given everything that's happened in 2020. Pretty incredible moment. But Kansas City Chiefs are the clear favorite here. Make no mistake. They are the more stable franchise from top to bottom. They are the ones that have their clear identity built, and they are a well-oiled machine. I mean, they just blew out a really, really good Buffalo Bills team. Blew them out of the water.
Looked like they were playing a different sport.
100%. And so it's going to have to take a tremendous amount of game planning from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to have a chance to beat the Kansas City Chiefs. That's why, to me, they are no question the underdog. All right, last one here. Tyreek Hill just doesn't seem real. He is like a created player out there. His speed, his instant separation doesn't even make sense. He's the first guy that I've truly seen. And there's some other guys who can fly. But truly, his speed, his 40 speed, I don't think does him justice. And that's saying that he runs a 4.2 40. That's blazing fast. That doesn't even do him justice. He runs and plays like he runs a 4.40 flat. I mean, it is crazy how anyone can try and keep up with this guy. I mean, it was on full display here. Cut number 12, Mahomes to Hill for 71 yards. Incredible, incredible run after catch by Tyreek Hill.
Going to throw a slant, caught, 35-yard line. Juke move, Tyreek Hill, 45, 50-yard line. Cuts it back, look out, 40, 35, 30. Cheetah at full speed, 10 to the 5-yard line. You play impress, the cheetah will run you all the way around the earth. It's a 71-yard pass play.
Not only does he get instant separation at the beginning from Tyron Johnson, but when he catches the ball, he looks like he's gone. Then he has to cut back across the field, and I thought he was gone. I was surprised that Tyron Johnson even caught up with him when it was all said and done from that moment. But you watch him on film, and you literally have to question yourself if you've got a clicker in hand. Hey, is this in fast motion? Am I fast forwarding this when Tyreek Hill has the ball in his hands? That's how much speed and separation he has on film. He has a rare, rare quality that very, very few guys in the league have ever, ever had.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that you watch them play and you just think that guy is a game wrecker. Like if you get that guy in space, it's done. It's over. Got it, right? Paul Gallant watches. So when we're on the press box watching the games, there's a couple times a game where he'll be like, got him. And it's when you just know that a guy's wide open. I feel like Hill is one of the guys where, like, when it's still very much in the air before it's clear he's beat his guy, you're like, got him. It's just if he's one-on-one, you got him. It's really 100%. Fun to watch this Chiefs offense play. And you can tell that they're having fun.
Well, yeah, they're having fun.
Winning is fun.
It is a lot of fun, and putting up a bunch of yards and points is a lot of fun. But the combination of Tyreek Hill and Patrick Mahomes is such a unique one because Mahomes has a great ability to put the ball out there with anticipation and trust that Tyreek Hill is going to be there and run underneath it, and he often does. It's pretty incredible.
The 253, before I get to NFL headlines, says, Jake, thanks for calling it a clicker rather than a remote. It is a clicker.
It's both. I mean, tomato, tomato.
Well, this show is going to be clicker over remote every time.
Oh, really?
I'm just making that clear. Okay. Correct? We're all on board? Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Wonderful. Time for NFL headlines. Chiefs left tackle Eric Fisher tore his Achilles during the AFC Championship game and will obviously miss the Super Bowl. It is a huge hit for Kansas City's offense and their offensive line. At one point, Kansas City, correct me if I'm wrong, had four backups in at different times on their offensive line, getting pretty banged up. They still managed to dominate that performance against the Bills. It should, though, be making Chiefs fans nervous against a very, very good Tampa Bay defensive line.
Absolutely. Losing Eric Fisher is a big deal. You saw what the Green Bay Packers had to deal with when Bakhtiari went down and you had Jason Pierre-Paul dominating Green Bay's left tackle. I mean, Pierre-Paul, if you talk about mistakes, when you look at Greg Olsen, Curtis asked us earlier in the show with three questions about Greg Olsen, $7 million. Jason Pierre-Paul, $7 million, right? Or just a little bit above that. The Seahawks, that would have been an awesome signing to have with JPP. But he is still playing at a high level. You got Shaq Barrett on the other side. They can really get after the quarterback. And this also is going to put a lot of emphasis for the Kansas City Chiefs on how quickly they can get the ball out of Patrick Mahomes' hands. And guess what? They're one of the best in the NFL at getting that done. And it will be a unique challenge, though, Stacey. That will be one. That'll be a matchup to definitely keep an eye on in the Super Bowl.
Jake, what's the injury you say you suffered your freshman year? Was it a fibula?
Yes, it was fibula? A fibula. Broken
well,
fibula.
Well, guess who else had a broken fibula? It was Bills wide receiver Cole Beasley, only he said he played through his.
Well,
how do you feel?
Yeah, it doesn't make me feel good, but his probably was just like a teeny tiny fracture.
Right,
it wasn't
right.
Like the bone was completely broken. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time believing that he was running around with a completely broken fibula. Mm-hmm. Overhyped, overplayed storyline, Stacey.
Gotcha.
He's lying to you.
Wow.
He's lying. There's
like
no way.
Jealousy.
Also,
yeah.
He probably has a lot of like Tordal and things like that that can get him through that I didn't have at the time when I was a freshman.
Well,
in high school.
Jake, you could have had a painkiller, but
well, I mean, that was my freshman year in college when I broke my rib.
Right?
Yeah, I could have gotten a Tordal shot, but I decided not to. I was afraid of needles.
There you go.
I don't like needles. Sorry,
Freddy Pants Heaps over there.
I'd rather deal with the broken rib than the pain of that than get the shot.
Moving on, Greg Olsen has officially retired from the NFL after 14 seasons. His last season was maybe not everything some Seahawks fans were hoping it would be, but like Jake said, and I'm agreeing with him, I'm also putting some of that on how tight ends were used this year. Also, please don't forget that he tore his plantar fascia and still returned to play a couple games.
Yeah,
an unreal recovery from him. I think he leaves as one of the more popular players in the NFL. I saw so many just congratulations from players around the league for Greg Olsen. Super likable guy.
Very, very likable guy. I had the chance to be around him, work with him this offseason down in San Diego. And he, extremely smart guy, extremely likable. And you could see why he had so much success in his career. I mean, one of the more prolific tight ends that we've seen in the NFL, and had a tremendous run with the Carolina Panthers because he was a very, very smart player, knew exactly where he needed to be, where he needed to be for the quarterback, and he had an insane catch rate. I mean, it was something like over 95% catch rate. Very, very reliable hands. And, you know, I think Greg Olsen, it's going to be fun to see him make that transition into the booth. I'll say this. It's the perfect transition for Greg Olsen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Greg Olsen, nonstop talker. You're out there on the field and you can barely get in routes because he just wants to talk through everything. It's like, dude, it's been like 10 minutes since the last route we run. Let's get going. But he is highly entertaining, and I know that everybody in Seattle really enjoyed him in that organization. It's just unfortunate that it couldn't have been more productive.
NFL on CBS tweeting out where he ranks with all-time tight ends. He is fifth in receptions with 742, sixth in all-time receiving yards with 8,600, and tied for ninth in receiving touchdowns with 60. End of a great NFL career. All right, coming up, per Albert Breer, the Seahawks have put in a request to interview Bills quarterbacks coach Ken Dorsey for their offensive coordinator job. They are not the first team, says Breer. Dorsey's name has been a popular one. How would he be a fit with Seattle's offense? We'll talk about that next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Rost.
According to Albert Breer, the Seahawks put in a request to interview Bills quarterback coach Ken Dorsey for their offensive coordinator job. Now, he is on now a long-ish list of names the Seahawks have spoken to. Jake, you published an article on 710sports.com listing 11 of those names. A few of those guys have since found some positions, so you had narrowed it down to three. So we'll get to those guys right after your immediate reaction to this news about Dorsey.
It doesn't surprise me to hear that they're going to go after Ken Dorsey, and Ken Dorsey is a guy that is in kind of is in demand right now. I mean, you look at him, there's a lot of other programs out there, organizations that are interested in Ken Dorsey as an offensive coordinator. He's at that point of his career where, especially after the season with Josh Allen having his best numbers yet, that people are looking at Ken Dorsey as a guy who is exceptionally good at developing quarterbacks and being a sounding board for them. And he's been around a lot of ball, not just as a player, but also during his time as a coach. He's coached under North Turner, did an excellent job of helping Cam Newton and navigating his personality and finding ways to make him successful on the field. And then also now having 3 years of working with Josh Allen, I think gives him a unique background. I think that if the Seahawks are really, really, truly interested in Ken Dorsey, which is what it seems like, they're going to have a lot of competition with the Miami Dolphins. It seems like that's going to be the next stage, trying to get Tua the best possible system around him of coaches and guys that know how to handle the quarterback position. And if you're Deshaun Watson and they hired Ken Dorsey as your offensive coordinator, I think you should be very, very excited about what they did. They added Charlie Fry as a quarterback coach who is well regarded in coaching circles at the quarterback position. Adding Ken Dorsey as well would be intriguing. But for the Seahawks, what does Dorsey bring that could benefit this offense? That's the key. That's the number one question. I believe there's a background in systems and a way to attack defenses, utilize the strengths of your talent to be able to come up with the best strategies possible. Also, what the Bills were able to do with Josh Allen is they put a lot on Allen. They put a lot of check with me's, meaning two plays at the line of scrimmage, and having Josh Allen get them into the right plays, into the right system, into the right calls at the moment. And I think that that's what Dorsey can bring to the table for the Seattle Seahawks. When you talk about a quarterback in Russell Wilson who took a couple steps forward in terms of his ability and his command at the line of scrimmage, particularly He showed that in the first 8 weeks of the season, and you really pulled back the reins of Russ's control at the line of scrimmage. Ken Dorsey comes from a background in Buffalo where they empowered their quarterback to do just that. And I think that could be the possibility of why they would be interested in Ken Dorsey. But if you also look at the Buffalo Bills this past season, it wasn't necessarily a great fit if you're looking at it from Pete Carroll's perspective with the lack of run game that they had, especially later in the year and into the playoffs.
Is there one of the coordinators, and I know that your answer is going to involve bringing those names back that we talked about earlier in the show, is there a coordinator still remaining that would interest genuinely both Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll?
I think Nathaniel Hackett would be the guy, Green Bay's offensive coordinator right now, and you'd have to pay him significant money to get him away from the Green Bay Packers. You'd have to have permission from the Green Bay Packers to be allowed to interview him, and you would probably have to add assistant head coach, that title, to Nathaniel Hackett for him to be able to move on from the Green Bay Packers, and the Packers not being allowed to just automatically decline the interview. That would be the guy that I would really love to see, but I would have a really hard time seeing the Green Bay Packers doing that. So the next guy that I really think would be a great candidate is Rams passing game coordinator Shane Waldron.
So we already know Nathaniel Hackett, a guy that would interest both Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll. Then I asked you about, okay, what about the most creative play caller? Which guy might be the best fit if you are very much ready to lean into the run? Not that that's a bad thing. I mean, you struggled to consistently establish that this year, and it does help Russell Wilson on the offensive side of the ball, clearly.
I mean, it does. It does help. I don't know if there's any one candidate that you look at that they've interviewed thus far and said, yeah, this is the guy. The only guy that I would have said that about is Anthony Lynn, mm-hmm. who is now the offensive coordinator with the Detroit Lions. He's the guy that in his years and in his background has been really good and well-respected in terms of his ability to get great production out of the running backs, help create a strong running game. But he also didn't have the resume that would excite people in terms of him being an offensive coordinator, only being an offensive coordinator for 1 year in the NFL. The other name that you could look at with the same kind of resume is Kirby Wilson, but he has very rarely been interviewed as an offensive coordinator in the NFL. He's been a long-time running back coach. I just don't think that that's the hire that they would make. So out of the candidates right now that are currently out there, Pep Hamilton has a resume that has a background of being able to run the football during his time at Stanford, during his time in Indianapolis as the OC with Andrew Luck. He would be a guy that would make sense. And that's also another reason why I think Shane Waldron does make sense, because if you look at the Shanahan tree and you look at the way that all those guys, whether it's Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, Matt LaFleur, how they build their game plans, it is starting with the run game. That is the emphasis. That's where the offense success is predicated off of. Can you have an effective run game? And then from there, you can get to your deep play action shots. You can get to a variety of different things in terms of tempo, empty stuff. But it's all predicated off, can you run the football? And when Sean McVay had his best years, it was Todd Gurley. Kyle Shanahan obviously has been known for his ability to have a creative run game and a very good run scheme. And Matt LaFleur has been able to get the Green Bay Packers to 13-3 and two NFC championship games in a row. Yes, certainly because you have Aaron Rodgers, but also because they have been able to establish a really good run game there as well.
Now, is Luke Getsy the guy that we are hoping, okay, if you can't get Hackett, who's one of the favorites you want to target, Getsy is not second best, but I mean, he's the passing game coordinator over there. So
yeah, he's the passing game coordinator there. So if you're wanting somebody that is on that tree and has been a part of those meetings and those game plans and figuring out what they've been able to do to be so successful, Getsy has been there for a while. He was there with the end of the years of Mike McCarthy, and he was there also that remained under Matt LaFleur, and probably for good reason, that he had background with Aaron Rodgers, and Aaron Rodgers liked him, which is something that's very hard to do, coaches getting the approval of Aaron Rodgers, but also the fact that he has been a part of that game planning each and every single week. And so I think if you can't get Hackett, then Getsy is at least worth an interview. He's at least worth talking to and seeing if you can if you really are blown away by him. But obviously, Ken Dorsey is somebody that they're really interested in. And I love the fact that they interviewed Shane Waldron. I think that is more of the style in which those are more of the targets in which they should be going after if you can't get an experienced play caller.
Guys, I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. Just know that. I'm not complaining. But what's taking so long? I mean, really, you've seen... No, I'm serious. You've seen so many names that have been linked to this team that have since gone to other places, signed with other teams. And that includes some guys that you might want, like Mike LaFleur, who's since joined Saleh with the Jets. Could you have taken him from Saleh's staff? Probably not. He knows him. He probably believes in him, probably excited for that opportunity.
It's probably a gentleman's agreement that they have.
For sure. But, I mean, otherwise... Schottenheimer was hired, what, days after Bevel was fired? I mean, this is taken so much longer than I thought it would. I'm not complaining. I'm asking.
Because you're trying to get it right.
All right.
Because you're not just simply going after somebody that you know or that you think is going to serve the philosophy that you want. I think that Pete Carroll is pushing himself here. And for all the negativity that has been out there surrounding Pete Carroll and conversation of him wanting to go back and is he holding this offense back? Well, you do have to, I think, at the same token, take Russell Wilson for his word. And what was his word when he had his exit interview with the media? He said that he believes that Pete Carroll, John Schneider, and himself are on the same page in terms of the vision of 2021. And so if there are some coaches that you are interested in and that you really want to interview and you want to do your due diligence through this entire process, then I'm okay waiting to make sure that you get it right. And there hasn't been any offensive coordinator that has been stolen or that has been hired that I thought, oh, man, the Seahawks lost out on this one, that they truly had a shot at. And so I'm okay with them waiting. I don't think there's anybody on the Chiefs staff or the Buccaneers staff that they are interested in interviewing. They were interested in Mike Kafka, but we quickly found out that the Chiefs were like, no, you're not going anywhere. We are going to pay you more money. We're going to give you a little bit more say in the offensive game planning. We want you here. That was the only guy that was out there that's still playing ball right now. I believe, and Curtis, you tweeted out the other day that you didn't know if they would make a hire this week. I'm not saying they will. I'm not guaranteeing anything. But there's no reason why it couldn't happen. Everybody is available to them at this point. Mm. So I think that there were a few guys that they've been waiting on, holding out for, that they wanted to interview and then probably make their decision.
All right. Coming up in just a few minutes, what you need to know. Here's how it works. 710-710, that's our Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. You are going to send in any and all questions you have. It can be Seahawks, Mariners, Seattle sports, not Seattle sports, personal, anything that you want to have answered. Text in 710-710. What you need to know, coming up next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
All right, this is what you need to know. Here's how it works. You send in your question. What I need to know is blank, whatever you want to ask. You send that to 710-710. That's the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. I'm going to start with this fashion question. This is actually sent in earlier. What I need to know, bigger fashion no-no, socks with flip-flops or jean shorts? P.S. I'm guilty of both, sometimes at the same time.
Yikes.
I think that jean shorts, I would say, is the bigger fashion no-no. I don't mind socks with flip-flops.
Wait.
I don't see the problem.
Jean shorts is a problem for girls?
No, I think jean shorts for women is completely acceptable.
Okay, yeah, I would say...
I interpreted this as for men.
For men, yes. I would agree with that. Jean shorts for men, definitely questionable unless you're Gardner Minshew. Then I think you could pull it off. The socks... There's a difference. Because as an athlete, socks with flip-flops or slides, right? That's completely different. I think socks with slides is an okay look. It's comfortable. You're going from game to game, or
yeah,
you just got out of a game, so you're slipping on the socks and slides. But socks with legit sandals, that's
never a different story.
Never okay.
Different story. What I need to know, how are the Seahawks supposed to make any legitimate moves with so little cap space? I think that's a great question, one that the Seahawks obviously are going to have to answer, but one that as fans, as people watching, whether you're a reporter or just a fan watching at home, you're also genuinely wondering because they have very little cap space. I think it's one of two things. One, you get some rookies, really cheap free agent signings, and then you depend on development from the young players you have. So not necessarily new players you're going to bring in. This is when you look at the guys you already have on your roster and you say, time to step up. The second choice is addition by subtraction, which is getting more cap space, a significant amount of cap space, by parting ways via trade or releasing a big name starter that's taking up a big portion of your cap. I don't know how willing they are to do that.
Yeah, you're going to have to make some really tough choices. I'll just say that. So you're going to have to make some really tough choices roster-wise. Right now, Carlos Dunlap is part of that cap, right, that we're talking about, this equation. They're going to rework his deal. There's no way that you're going to leave Carlos Dunlap on the contract of a $14 million cap hit. So that will help you out. That'll give you some relief there. And then, yes, you're going to have to make some tough choices along the lines. But it would be great to be able to rely on finding and putting an emphasis on rookies, but you only got four picks. So how are you going to maximize those four picks in this draft here in 2021? Mm-hmm. Or is there a trade that you could make that you could get back some capital? And I think that's one thing to keep an eye out on for the offseason. That will definitely be a storyline, no question about that. But it's going to be extremely challenging, and I think that you're going to see the Seahawks probably ask for multiple players to ask to restructure their deals.
From the 360, what I need to know is, why should I watch the Mariners when they're still building? 360, I don't think you're alone in this take. Here's what I'll say about this. One of my favorite people to talk to about baseball, and we speak with him often, especially during the season, is Rick Riz. And one thing I love about Rick Riz, and I'll put Graz in this too, is they are amazing storytellers. And some of the best stories are when you saw something from the beginning. So there's stories about watching Ken Griffey Jr., you know, when he's a rookie or just at a practice when he's really young before everyone really knows what he's going to become. Am I saying any of the young players on the Mariners roster are going to be Ken Griffey Jr.? No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you are seeing the beginnings and the young careers of players that the Mariners plan on being part of their core moving forward. These aren't guys that they brought in and they're just going to say, oh, we'll trade him in a year. Hopefully they get us a couple wins. You're watching guys that hopefully, if all things go their way, should be in Seattle for many years to come. And you're watching them when they're like 23 years old.
Right. To me, this is the fun part.
Yeah.
Last year, the year before that, that was really difficult when they first decided to tear it down. Now they're getting to the next phase of it. They're getting closer. And this is where the excitement to me really ramps up in terms of what this team can be, how quickly can their stars rise, and what culture are they really setting for themselves. That to me really sets up this entire equation. This is the time to kind of get all in right now. And I think that it will be more rewarding if they do end up pulling this out and they are successful through this rebuilding process. I understand. Been there, done that. Been a part of this losing history. Most of my life has been, unfortunately, with the Mariners not being a winning organization. But I still have hope for this organization and the way that they have been moving, the way that they've been building over the next couple of years. Let's see if they can go execute that vision.
What I need to know, are you guys Slurpee people or Icy people?
Ooh, this is a really good question.
But it's not a difficult one.
Is it?
The answer is Slurpee.
I don't know, because at the movie theater...
That's what I'm saying.
At the movie theater with an Icy...
Yo... Blue raspberry?
Yeah, blue raspberry or
nothing
cherry.
Nothing is better than blue raspberry.
Or wild cherry.
Biggest size possible.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're talking about, like, 64 ounce. Yes.
Jake's holding
yes,
his
Curtis.
Arms like it's a 2-foot-tall Slurpee. But hear me out. Hot day. You stop in at a 7-Eleven.
Mm-hmm.
Get yourself a nice little...
roller dog.
A nice little roller dog. Nice little slice of pizza. Maybe a little pizza roll or something.
Yeah.
And then you fill up with a Slurpee on a hot day in the summer from a 7-Eleven. Ugh.
Yeah,
chef's kiss.
I probably would never get what'd you call it, a roller dog?
You haven't lived then.
I think my stomach has been just fine without that. But
it'll make your stomach stronger.
build up its...
Build up an immunity.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
We do, from time to time, the Heaps family does go on walks, and we will take walks to 7-Eleven, go get some Slurpees. That's like Jackson's, one of his favorite things to do. But I don't know. I'm going to have to say Icy at a movie theater is definitely my top choice.
What I need to know, is Derek Carr still going to be the Raiders quarterback?
I don't think so. I really think that the Raiders are looking to move on. Why would John Gruden just constantly have this non-committal attitude about Derek Carr? All it does, is, in my opinion, is put your organization kind of at an unease. And Derek Carr, I think it hasn't necessarily benefited him from that. And to me, if you're gonna constantly leave that door open, if you're John Gruden, at some point you got to go. You've gotten a 10-year contract because you are being trusted by Mark Davis to rebuild this team over that period of time. You don't rebuild the team into a legitimate winner without a draft pick at the quarterback position or a clear guy of the future like a Deshaun Watson who is young and who can go for it. So that to me is the remaining missing piece for the Raiders along with its pass rush.
What I need to know as a Lions fan, is there any hope this hot mess of an organization can turn things around? Here's what I'll say to that Lions fan. No one would judge you if you kept another fan base or another team on the back burner for a little while you rack up all those nice draft picks. You know what I mean? That's all I'm saying. No one will judge you if you are a fan of an organization that is struggling with a turnaround if you have another team that you're just kind of rooting for on the side.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like that.
What?
Be all in.
What if you want to have fun from a football season? If I'm a Jets fan this year, mm-hmm. I want another team that I kind of like watching too.
Okay,
otherwise,
that,
it's just agony.
No, that's fine. But don't act like you are, if that team goes to a Super Bowl, that all of a sudden you're that fan too.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You can have a rooting interest for that team,
right.
But don't act like you are a fan
of
that
team. Oh, you can't
wear
their jerseys.
No, you can't wear their jerseys.
Don't be
disrespectful. You can't wear their memorabilia. None of that. To me, that's unacceptable because then you can't go back to your old team, and that is the definition of, in my opinion, of being a bandwagoner fan.
If you didn't love the Lions when they were 5-11, you can't love them when they're 8-8.
Yeah, fair.
That's very fair. I think so too. All right, he is Jake Heaps. I'm Stacey Ross. Producer Curtis Rogers on the board. This has been Jake and Stacey. Don't go anywhere. Wyman and Bob is next on 710 ESPN.
This is
Seattle.
The weekend, Stacey.
Thanks, Jake.